Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have a very, very special guest with us. And before we get to Dave Emery, though, I want to mention that a week from tonight at the Shiloh Inn, and of course this is aimed at the people in the Northwest in the Seattle area, at the Shiloh Inn there's going to be a second meeting of the Institute of the Constitution. Actually, they're starting another Institute of the Constitution on Thursday, September the 25th. That's a week from tonight. At 7 p.m. at the Shiloh Inn in Spokane, it'll be a six-week course. Those interested should call 509-891-7428. That's 509-891-7428. And then, of course, on October 22nd, which will be just about a month from now, why Dr. John Eidsmo is going to be speaking at the Shiloh Inn, and that's at 923 East 3rd Avenue in Spokane. And, of course, it'll be an amazing opportunity to hear an expert in constitutional law. So that'll be Dr. John Eidsmo on the 22nd of October. But remember, next Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Shiloh Inn, there will be beginning a new Institute of the Constitution. And, of course, it's so important people understand the foundations of our freedom, because how can you defend something you don't understand? And with that as a background, let's introduce our very special guest. You know, many years ago, when I was just getting started studying what was going on in the world, there was a woman in the Monterey Bay area. Her name was Mae Brussel. And Mae, of course, was one of the people who talked about a vast conspiracy in the world. And she began putting all the pieces together. And, of course, people were fascinated listening to Mae as she began cataloging and chronicling the information she had, and a great deal of that information was fascinating and extremely accurate. Well, when Mae passed on, Dave Emery picked up where she left off, had her records, and he is, of course, doing a regular program over in the Santa Clara area on a weekly basis, but I wanted to have him back on our program again. We've had him here before, talking about Martin Bormann, and, of course, what most Americans don't understand is at the end of the Second World War, why our government, which had worked with the Nazis during the war, and certainly many of our corporations had helped to finance the Nazi movement both before and during the war, And, of course, many of the Nazi scientists were brought over here under Operation Paperclip, and many of the Nazis were helped to escape to South America by the OSS. And among them, of course, was Martin Bormann. And with that as a background, I'm going to let Dave Emery develop these ideas on the incredible story of Martin Bormann, the number two man, second only to Adolf Hitler in the Third Reich. David, thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, it's a pleasure being back, Stan. Now, I'm speaking on a speakerphone here. Is it coming in okay for your listeners? Is this a good level?
Yes, it really is. Seems to be all right. It's usually better on a regular telephone, but if you want to use a speakerphone for time being, let's see how it does.
All righty. Yeah, our facilities here are somewhat damaged, so some intemperate person slammed the phone down too hard, and so the switch is broken, so we're limited to the speakerphone here.
All right, fine. Well, then the speakerphone is just perfect.
Good. Well, once again, thank you so much for having me back. These are very interesting times in the expression of that old curse. It's a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. And I think these times are, as Dr. Spock would have said on the old Star Trek series, fascinating.
No question at all. And of course, the important thing, though, is that the average person out there has no idea what's happening. It's like going to a football game, and if you don't have a program, you don't know who the players are, and that's your job, and my job is to help people understand who the players are on the political field that we see, or the political stage, and what they really represent, not what you read about in the newspaper, but who is behind the people, who is creating them, and who is creating our reality.
Absolutely. If I were going to express what I believe to be going on in just a few sentences, it might seem like utter madness to members of the listening audience. So what I'm going to ask, Dr. Stan, is that you sort of act as something of an anchor or a buoy here in terms of cognition for the audience. Certainly you know your audience better than I do. And it's a situation that's a little bit difficult. It's kind of like the 16th century. If we lived in the 16th century, and if the church had declared mathematics to be the work of the devil, but if one had seen the calculations of Copernicus and Galileo, and if one knew, in fact, that the earth was round and not flat, and if we knew that the earth revolved around the sun, not the other way around, this would be a difficult thing to explain to people. It would be possible to do it, but the superficial appearances are otherwise, and beyond that, we face the inertia of not only contemporary theological thought, but scientific and political thought, which runs in the opposite direction. So our job is a little bit like that of trying to express truths which, although vitally important, although readily documentable if one knows how to do it, are also not only against the grain, but psychologically very disturbing to people, and that's just not an easy thing to do.
Well, of course, our job is not to make people feel good, is to tell them the truth and hope that they will accept it, or better still, that they will try to prove us wrong. That's what happened to me some 40 years ago. I tuned into the wrong television program, and I heard things I didn't believe, and so I set out to prove them wrong, and I'm still involved in that same study today.
Well, that's an important thing to do, and the documentation is there. What I believe is going on now, what is affecting the United States, is literally a continuation of the Second World War. The Axis powers, particularly Germany, but also Japan, did not go away. Rather, their more obvious and obnoxious, the more obvious and obnoxious elements of their political culture, the symbolic elements were removed, and the horrors and the political, the mechanisms of political aggression of both Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan went underground. And there were two basic obstacles in the way of this underground Axis and this underground Reich. One was socialism and the former Soviet Union, and in addition to the alliances that you've already alluded to, in which Martin Bormann, people like Reinhard Gehlen, Heinrich Müller, many of the heavyweights in the Third Reich intelligence system went to work for the United States to use against communism. The same thing was happening in Europe. There's a great book, Dr. Stan, by an author named Kevin Coogan. The book is called Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey, and the Post-War Fascist International. And it's about a Third Reich intelligence agent and a guy who's been very, very influential in the post-war fascist right named Francis Parker Yockey. But what the book reveals is that at the same time as these Nazis were hooking up to the United States, they were also hooking up with the former Soviet Union. They were working both sides against the middle. They were saying to the Americans, look, we're going to work with you against these communists. And the Americans said, yeah, great, no, we need that. And then they were saying to the Soviets and also to the Chinese and the Cubans and others, look, we're going to work with you against these Americans with their Coca-Cola and chewing gum imperialism. And they said, great. But in fact, they were working both sides against the middle. In addition to these very, very powerful espionage organizations, such as the Reinhard Gehlen Eastern Front spy outfit that we've spoken about previously on your show, run by the very deadly, formidable Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, the security chief for a Third Reich gone underground under Martin Bormann, the U.S. Was afflicted with, and I think that's a good term, it was afflicted with these huge intelligence alignments with elements of the Gestapo, elements of the SS, elements which, although anti-communist, certainly were at least, I think, even more vehemently opposed to and hating of the United States, because after all, the United States was top dog, so to speak. We were the dominant power in the world and completely anathema to what the Nazis were all about. Every aspect of American political culture, even our culture itself, our music and our way of dress was anathema to them. And so we had allied ourselves during the Cold War with an element that is consummately evil. Even at the core of the SS philosophy is an occult religious philosophy that is anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, even anti-Muslim, anti-monotheist, and which would be difficult, I think, for most people to even comprehend. So we allied in order to defeat the Soviets during the Cold War with a deadly, powerful element that was just as determined to destroy us. And that same alignment had also, that same entity, this underground axis, had allied itself with the Soviet Union as well.
Let me just interrupt for a moment. For our listeners out there, of course, Dave is referring to Gerhard Gehlen. General Gehlen was a part of Hitler's military intelligence, and at the end of the Second World War, he was hired by the United States because, of course, he had a great deal of intelligence on the communists, and so he was our, of course, director or in charge of the our monitoring of what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, and then, of course, eventually he went to work for the German government, but he was a Nazi general. That was General Gehlen, and there's books written about General Gehlen, and of course Heinrich Mueller, who we referred to, was the head of the SS, and the government, of course, if you go up on the internet, why they will CIA will try to tell you that Heinrich Mueller died. He died, and he died over and over again, because of course the last thing they would want would be for anybody in the United States to realize that we would hire a man like Heinrich Mueller to work for us. Now, was Heinrich Mueller in Germany or was he here in the United States, to your best of your knowledge?
As far as I can tell, Heinrich Mueller was in various places. He had been in Europe during the closing stage of the war and helped to oversee the diaspora, the Nazi diaspora that took place, including the exodus to Latin America. As far as I can tell, and of course he's a very powerful intelligence professional, as far as I can tell, most of his career was spent physically in Latin America. But
after the war, you're speaking of now.
Yes, after the war, it was in Latin America. His primary assignment was the personal security of Martin Bormann. But he ran, his title was Minister of the Interior of the Third Reich in exile. And so he had basically the responsibilities of an interior minister, and his overall supervision of the post-war Nazi intelligence apparatus, including the Gehlen organization, which is a fascinating thing to contemplate. Reinhard Gehlen, as you already mentioned, Stan, was the Nazi chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front. He had a lot of operatives in place in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and he had all of his files intact. And as such, he was utilized by the U.S. to basically help form the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. He became the de facto NATO intelligence chief for use against the Soviet Union, ultimately head of the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, which was the German intelligence service. Yet at the same time, he had operatives working not only with the Soviets, but working to restore a Third Reich. There was a very interesting detail that was provided in an essay by Carl Oglesby. He's written, among other books, The Yankee and Cowboy War. And he mentioned that when Galen, by the way, was brought into the United States in the uniform of a four-star general in July of 1945, even before the guns had fallen silent in Asia, and he was given the pay of a four-star general, and even though he was officially a prisoner of war, Galen was clearing his actions with Admiral Karl von Dönitz, who had succeeded Hitler as the nominal head of state of Germany, as well as with General Franz Halder, who had been Galen's chief of staff. So the interesting thing about that is that even when Galen was officially a prisoner of war, even when he was officially America's most important intelligence chief working against the Soviets and their allies, he was still operating as part of a Third Reich chain of command which had remained intact. So basically, we have this Nazi Trojan horse embedded within our intelligence system. And even more important than that, I believe, and that's certainly not a fact that one wants to overlook, but at the same time, there were tremendous economic connections that existed between the most powerful American corporations and banks and their counterparts in Germany and in Japan as well.
You're talking IG Farben, I suppose, and the relationship between that and Standard Oil?
And Standard Oil, relationships between General Motors, the Ford Motor Company, International Harvester. There are tremendous relationships between these corporations. To try to make a long story short, to give people an idea of the basic mechanism, and I may fail in what I'm about to do, Stan, so I'll apologize in advance, because I'm going to try to make some things that are very big and very important kind of simple and short. But in the 1920s, the U.S. was the only major power that was intact economically. The warring powers of Europe had either disintegrated in the case of the Russian and Ottoman empires, or they basically had gone hopelessly into debt to finance their activities in World War I, plus their industrial labor forces had basically been slaughtered in the trenches. So the U.S. stood alone for all intents and purposes economically after World War I. We experienced this huge economic boom, which was popularized as the Roaring Twenties, driven by the automobile, driven by the fact that we were the world's biggest creditor nation, and also driven by speculation in radio stocks. But the only way that capitalism can work is if capital is invested in such a way as to generate more capital. It has to be set up kind of like a hydraulic system. Sometimes I use the metaphor of the tank versus the bulldozer. If you're going to invest all your money in tanks, well, who pays for the tank? Well, the public. That comes out of the public sector. And who pays for the fuel that the tank uses? Well, that comes out of your tax dollars. And who pays for the ammunition? Well, that comes out of your tax dollars. Who pays the salaries of the people that drive it and maintain it? That comes out of the tax dollars. This is not to say that I don't believe in a strong military. I certainly do. But if a nation is going to spend its money on tanks rather than bulldozers, it's going to go into debt. Now, if we look at a bulldozer, who pays for the bulldozer? Comes out of the private sector. Who pays for its parts? The private sector. Who pays for the gas? The private sector. Who pays for the people that drive it and maintain it? The private sector. But most importantly, rather than just going on maneuvers and tearing up the ground and shooting shells, the bulldozer is building shopping centers, homes, factories. Those shopping centers, those factories, those movie theaters are going to employ people. They're going to have jobs, and they're going to have discretionary income. That's going to create demand for goods and services. And that's basically, I realize I'm putting a lot into a small package, but that's the way capitalism has to work. You've got to invest capital in such a way as to generate more capital. Now, the powerful forces in the United States in World War One, or after World War One, basically looked around, and because of the antitrust laws that had been passed by Teddy Roosevelt, and because they wanted to derive a greater profit from their investments than they would have been able to in the United States, they took advantage of something called the Webb-Parmalee Act. And that was a loophole in the antitrust laws, which permitted them, they couldn't form trusts, they couldn't form monopolies in the United States, but they could form trusts and monopolies with foreign corporations. An international monopoly is called a cartel. So what they began doing is, instead of investing the enormous profits from the 20s boom in the United States, it was invested in totalitarian systems in Italy, in Germany, in Japan, and basically that helped to capitalize fascism.
We'll be right back in just a moment here. Just hold that thought.
Okay.
All right, this is David, Dr. Stan, and Dave Emery is talking about, of course, how we managed to capitalize the markets in Germany and Japan and Italy, bringing, of course, the fascist government in Italy, the Nazi government in Germany, and, of course, the resurgence of Japan. Go ahead.
Well, it basically is an early example of globalization. The economic power, which transmogrified into military power in Germany and Italy and Japan, and which then surged all over much of the world with such destructive effect in World War II, was basically the transmogrified investment capital from the American boom of the 1920s. There were tremendous links between very, very powerful American corporations, the Ford Motor Company, General Motors, DuPont, one of the most important families in working out some of these links were the Walker and Bush families. Our current president of the United States is from a family that was at the very epicenter of these Nazis and Nazi investments. George Herbert Walker, who was his grandfather, or Herbert Walker, excuse me, who was George W.'s great-grandfather, and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., became involved with the Thyssens. That's spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. And they put together a huge steel cartel called Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. It later became Thyssen AG, Thyssen Octen Gesellschaft. And that became the dominant steel firm in pre-Hitler and Hitler Germany. Then after the war, much of their profits, much of the Bush family's profits, came from the dissolution of the Thyssen firm. There were other Bush family investments in Nazi Germany. A fellow named Alan Dulles, somebody that you've spoken about in the past, and somebody you can certainly fill the audience in on, was the advisor for the Bush family investments in Nazi Germany. And the relevance for today is that these huge capital relationships in which cartels were formed between very powerful American corporations and banks and the most powerful corporations in Japan and Italy and Germany in the pre-World War II and World War II period perpetuated themselves after the war. Although some of the more obnoxious and superficially evident Japanese fascists and German fascists and Italian fascists took off their uniforms, some were even subjected to discipline, these structural economic relationships, these cartel agreements between very, very powerful American corporations and their counterparts in Germany and Japan and Italy were perpetuated. And the German end of this in particular, the German capital interests were maintained by one of the most important and one of the most intelligent and one of the most cynically ruthless individuals in history, an organizational genius named Martin Bormann, who was the real power behind the throne in Nazi Germany, so to speak. He was the guy who basically ran Hitler. Heinrich Müller, the deadly Gestapo chief in the World War II.
Now, Dave, you're going to have to hold that thought for just a moment because, of course, we're going to return with, our, of course, our guests up the Great Northwest in just a moment here.
Sure.
And we're back again, and, of course, our guest is Dave Emery. He's talking about, of course, Martin Bormann, and, of course, Martin Bormann, number two man in the German hierarchy, of course, very... But, of course, he was the man who was really running Hitler. He was running all of, course, the economy and much of the military action within Germany when the Third Reich was in control. So pick the story up there, Dave.
All righty. Well, the at the end of World War II, basically, the Third Reich went underground. It did not disappear, but it went underground, and it has perpetuated itself in a very deadly and effective mafia-like fashion. This might seem strange to listeners, but just think about the movies, the Godfather movies. They begin at the end of World War II when the Al Pacino character is coming home from service in World War II, and they continue up from that time. Now, I think that listeners can envision how the mafia can perpetuate itself in a very effective, albeit underground, and yet very deadly fashion for generations. And something similar has happened with the Third Reich and also with fascist-slash-imperial Japan. They don't wear uniforms, but using the tremendous economic power, not only the investment power from the American boom of the 1920s, but also the tremendous capital that they got from the looting of occupied Europe and Asia. There's a book that's just out, Dr. Stan, called Gold Warriors, by Peggy and Sterling Seagraves. And this is a follow-up to a book that they did called The Yamato Dynasty. If listeners would like to follow up some of the things that I'm saying about Japan and get that documentation, the book The Yamato Dynasty by Peggy and Sterling Seagraves is a remarkable book. It's very readable, very well documented, and it neither sensationalizes nor pulls punches, which is kind of unusual. A lot of books either pull punches or else are so sensational. They go, oh, wow, look at this. It's a big conspiracy. This book is very well written, and it doesn't pull punches, but it's not sensational. But it's very well documented. And so The Yamato Dynasty by Peggy and Sterling Seagraves would be a really good book to read about the investment connections between the U.S. and Japan. And then a new book that those same authors have published called Gold Warriors talks about how the loot from occupied Asia and occupied Europe helped not only to finance post-war fascist activities, but it was helped to finance U.S. covert operations as well. The point being that during the prosecution of the Cold War, our brave airmen and women and our intelligence operatives were necessarily involved in some of the corrupting activities of this post-war fascist entity. A lot of the money came from that. And the Bormann organization in particular drew on what British intelligence estimated to be $143 billion that they had looted from occupied Europe. That does not include what they took from occupied Soviet Union or what they took out of Greece. And bear in mind, that's in early 1940s dollars, $143 billion. That's B as in billion dollars. And that is on top of what they already had and on top of what they got during the Marshall Plan. And this tremendous resource, this huge, huge pool of capital, was secreted out to neutral countries and was stashed in corporate fronts, which were available to the giant German corporations, and then later, by extension, to their American cartel partners. And this gave the Bormann organization, and to a lesser extent their Japanese counterparts, who had done something similar under Operation Golden Lily, in which all of the liquid wealth of occupied Asia was plundered by Japan in order to help finance their post-war reconstruction. This gave an underground fascist Japanese empire, and even more importantly, an underground fascist Third Reich, both with very, very strong connections to the United States, not only in terms of the structural economic relationships, but in terms of the national security relationships that had been formed to fight the Cold War. So the price that the United States and its people have paid for these relationships, in my opinion, is that now, with the demise of the Soviet Union, we are their next target, or perhaps already their subjugated state.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment here with Dave Emery and... Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening is David Emmerin. He's talking about, of course, these organizations that work behind the scenes. Now, you remember at the beginning of the program, he talked about the occult nature of the Third Reich, and of course there are strong occult relationships in Japan as well. What people do not understand is everything has been done to suppress from the American people the realization that, of course, the entire foundation of the Third Reich was in the occult. There are a number of books we have on the occult Reich and the relationship between Hitler and these various Thule Society and Theosophy and other basically Luciferian organizations. We know that Winston Churchill did everything he could to suppress this from being brought out at Nuremberg. And, of course, there has been one program, I think it's on Discovery, on the occult Reich, very, very good. I recommend it to you. But the average individual thinks of Adolf Hitler simply as a military leader. No, he was a spiritual leader as well. And, of course, what energized the Gestapo, what energized the SS, what energized the Nazi movement was the occult. And, of course, we can see the same thing in the relationship to Japan as well. So why don't you pick it up from there, David?
Well, it is a political and economic entity that, at one level, is inextricably linked. It's deeply filigreed with American power and economic structure. And yet, I don't think that Americans really appreciate not only how deeply involved, and when I say this, this is simply because most Americans have not been informed about this, Dr. Stan. It's why I do what I do, and it's why you do what you do, is to try to get the word out. But the bottom line is that this country, which I care for very deeply, is deeply involved with elements that are not only intractably opposed to the American way of life. Literally, I believe that we are involved in a continuation of the Second World War, and the Axis is underground and is infiltrating and subjugating and corrupting the United States, and I believe that they have in mind nothing less than the destruction or perhaps complete subjugation of the United States and its people and its way of life. And it would be extremely difficult to explain to the average citizen just how evil, how acutely evil these people are, how terribly powerful they are in terms of the influence within corporations. One of the things that is taking place is that as the world economy becomes globalized, many of these corporations affiliated with Martin Bormann and his deadly organization, affiliated with the Keiretsu or the Zaibatsu, the names for the giant family corporations that ran Imperial Japan, these are now the dominant elements that are controlling American life. And these aren't just economic and commercial relationships. It's not just that one buys a Japanese car or a German car or a piece of Japanese electronic equipment or a piece of German electronic equipment, underlying these corporate relationships is a degree of evil, both a political evil that at least became relatively well known to Americans in the Second World War period and through the history that's been written about that, and even beyond that, a spiritual evil that is something that I frankly found most Americans to be utterly refractory to in terms of explanation. I think that if we do not rally ourselves, if loyal, sincere, dedicated Americans of all kinds, of all political persuasions, of all religious persuasions, of all ethnic affiliations, but Americans who take the idea of America seriously, if they are not willing to get together and put aside their smaller differences and basically redo the work of World War II, I don't mean physically attacking Japan or Germany, but if we don't begin to negate the influences that have been propagated by this, from the assassinations of our political leaders such as President Kennedy, his brother Robert, Martin Luther King, the generation of AIDS, the corruption of society with the massive importation of drugs through elements of the intelligence community, the creations of weapons that could annihilate the entire earth, the use of surrogate warriors, such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Taqwa, because there are significant elements in the Islamic world that could be called fascist. And these are elements that were utilized by the Third Reich in order to help not only drive the British and French out of the Middle East, but also to try to get control over those parts of the former Soviet Union that had oil, and also to wipe out the Jews who were already beginning to move into what is now called Israel. That same dynamic, get rid of now the U.S., since we're the predominant power in the world, but get rid of the U.S. and also to a lesser extent Britain, get control of the oil, get control of those parts of the former Soviet Union that are Muslim and have oil, and wipe out the Jews is one of the dynamics that we're seeing with Al-Qaeda and its Al-Taqwa affiliations. Al-Taqwa is the bank of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, in turn, is an Islamo-fascist organization. It is a perversion of Islam into a fascist manifestation of Islam, and it is one of the elements that was implicated in the funding of Al-Qaeda. When the Operation Green Quest raids took place on March 20th of 2002, entities closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood that took its economic doctrine from Nazi Germany and fascist Italy were found to be at the core of the funding of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. And so as we attempt to relate this, Dr. Stan, as we attempt to relate some things that we've been talking about, which certainly would appear to be a long way from home for the average American, and that's not meant in any way to be condescending or self-righteous, but I think as we look, for example, at what's taking place with Al-Qaeda, with September 11th, we can understand that peoples within the Islamic world, not all Muslims, but some elements of the Muslim community, the Arab community in particular, are being used as proxy warriors, that they are being used as proxy forces by an underground Reich, sort of a virtual state, as it was called by one analyst, a state that exists but without formal geographical borders, and these proxy warriors are being used to destroy the United States, to launch catastrophic attacks like September 11th, to kill American soldiers and civilians around the world, and perhaps even more importantly, to force the United States to commit vital economic resources in order to conduct this war, at the same time that some of the corporate allies of the Bormann Group, of the underground Japanese Empire, very, very powerful elements, are plundering money and investing it in some of these offshore tax havens. There's never been a world leader who has slashed revenues while waging war. I did a program that I titled Pecunia Nervus Belli, which comes from Tacitus, the Roman historian. It means money is the sinew of war. And quite simply, you can't slash taxes while waging war. If you're going to wage war, you have to raise revenues. This has always been true. And I think that what we face, Dr. Stan, is that we face, as a country, as a civilization, a program of attack from without by some of the Islamo-fascist proxy warriors that are being used by this underground Reich, and subversion from within, the looting of our resources, the channeling of it into offshore banks, at the same time as Americans are being turned against one another over relatively superficial cultural matters. We are basically being subjected to the divide and conquer method, so that while we are at each other's throats over what were actually, in many cases, relatively superficial considerations, our money is being invested abroad. We are not getting the money invested at home to re-establish our manufacturing base. We're losing manufacturing jobs. The types of jobs that were available to a high school graduate when I was a young man, and by the way, today is my 54th birthday, but when I graduated from high school, a man or a woman could get a job in the manufacturing sector. And they had a chance to draw a decent wage and a decent benefits package to buy their own home, and this was a ticket into the middle class. But that doesn't exist anymore because so many of these jobs have now been farmed outside of the United States.
But of course, David, this has been done by the elite that run America, that have this this vision of a new world order, a new world religion, and they're the ones really behind this globalization. They're the ones, you know, who are working to undermine our moral fabric, and they're the ones, of course, who object to English being the one language. They want, of course, a dual language nation so they can play English against Hispanic, Hispanic against the English, and then, of course, divide us on the moral issues as well.
Well, they a lot of things are being used to distract us. What I'm going to do here is now I'd like to move to the subject of Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is something that I've spoken about at considerable length. And I am afraid, I've done some research on Schwarzenegger, and I think that he is somebody who has been tabbed by the underground Reich, by the Bormann Organization, certainly to lead California, the sixth largest economy in the world. And there's already an amendment that has been introduced by Orrin Hatch, who's a friend of Schwarzenegger's, to make it possible for a naturalized citizen such as Schwarzenegger to run for president. But before we get to Schwarzenegger, there is a passage that is from The Art of War by Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese military philosopher who wrote hundreds of years ago. And if I were going to sum up what I think is being done to the American people by this underground Reich and this underground Japanese empire and their very powerful allies in the American power elite, it would be this. Now, I'm going to quote from Sun Tzu, and interestingly enough, in his Art of War, there was a passage that was quoted in the memoirs of Reinhard Gehlen, that Nazi intelligence chief that we spoke about earlier. And I want to encourage the listeners, and you, Dr. Stan, listen very carefully to this program for the destruction of a society, and see if this doesn't resonate with what is taking place in the United States. Sun Tzu wrote, "There is no art higher than that of destroying the enemy's resistance without a fight on the battlefield. The direct tactic of war is necessary only on the battlefield, but only the indirect tactic can lead to a real and lasting victory. Subvert anything of value in the enemy's country. Implicate the emissaries of the major powers in criminal undertakings. undermine their position and destroy their reputation in other ways as well, and expose them to the public ridicule of their fellow citizens. Do not shun the aid of even the lowest and most despicable people. Disrupt the work of their government with every means you can. Spread disunity and dispute among the citizens of the enemy's country. Turn the young against the old. Use every means to destroy their arms, their supplies, and the discipline of the enemy's forces. Debase old traditions and accepted gods. Be generous with promises and rewards to purchase intelligence and accomplices. Send out your secret agents in all directions. Do not skimp with money or with promises, for they yield a high return. In a nutshell, Stan, I think that's what's being done to the United States. I'd like to hear your reaction to that, Pat.
No, I certainly think that there's a conscious effort to destroy our belief in everything, to discredit our leaders, and, of course, there's people sort of a joke about you can tell when a politician's lying because his lips are moving. And yet, of course, we need good politicians. We need good leaders. And yet, of course, we really don't have any. And so there is a tremendous growing disillusionment in America. And, of course, with the disillusionment in America, that seems many people are sort of almost turning against our traditions without understanding that there's nothing wrong with our traditions. We just need to reclaim them.
I agree. I think that there is a lot of knee-jerk anti-Americanism, and I think that and one sees this both on the right and the left. I think part of it is that people don't take a sense of responsibility for their own political and intellectual culture. They see this as though this were a show that they were watching on television, or perhaps a play that they were attending, whereas this is something that involves them and their loved ones and their fellow citizens to the most profound degree, and something that cannot be viewed as peripheral or transitory. It ultimately is what they will experience, for better or for worse, and I think it is absolutely essential for us to grasp that and to do the best we can with what's in front of us.
Well, of course, if you were listening when I opened the program this evening, I was talking about these programs that are going to be held up in Spokane. And, of course, this is the Institute of the Constitution is a training program to rekindle flickering flame of freedom that burns in most people's hearts with an understanding really of our form of government, its spiritual foundation, the high and lofty ideas that once made America the envy of the entire world. And so all across America, and I'm working with the people who are doing this, these institutes of the Constitution are being set up, and people are once again learning what they never learned in school, what is actually censored today in the average school, what our political leaders will never tell us, what our media denies, and that is the true history of America and why we need to reclaim it. So this has to be a very aggressive program, and I do encourage our listeners, get involved, because if not you, who, and not now, when it's too late? Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, I think that somebody who we need to pay a lot more attention to than we have been, and that is Der Terminator, so to speak, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger, of course, was a very successful bodybuilder, a championship bodybuilder. He then parlayed that into a career as an action hero in the motion picture industry. And now, largely on celebrity power, he is moving to become governor of California, the sixth largest economy in the world. And beyond that, there is a constitutional amendment that has been introduced by Orrin Hatch, a Republican of Utah, a friend of Schwarzenegger's, to allow an American citizen who is naturalized to run for president of the United States. And Schwarzenegger, in offhand comments, has indicated that he would like to run for president. I've done a couple of programs about Arnold Schwarzenegger. They are available on the Internet. Both programs are streaming on Real Audio at wfmu.org /Day Memory. That's WilliamFredMaryUnion.org, /Day Memory, DAVEEMORY. And I've also put an extended description of each program with vital text about Arnold Schwarzenegger. And one of the things that I want to stress to listeners is I think there is a very significant body of information indicating the possibility that Schwarzenegger may have been tabbed as the Führer for the Underground Reich's eventual subjugation of the United States. Now, he certainly is someone who has expressed recreational tastes, shall we say, in keeping with some of the more loose and contemporary California social ideals. He doesn't appear to be particularly authoritative in terms of his stance towards medical marijuana or abortion or gay rights. But if you look at his history, he in fact has been elevated by some very, very powerful economic interests, and he is not the outsider. He's not Mr. Everyman that he professes to be.
Well, certainly his association with them, with George Shultz and Warren Buffett, and of course George Shultz is part of the power elite in this country, affiliated with Gorbachev, affiliated with the Council on Foreign Relations, certainly Secretary of State in the Reagan administration, man behind him, Matt Fong, when he ran for Senate. George Shultz would be described, I think, as a kingmaker.
Most definitely. And Warren Buffett is the second richest man in the world. In May of 2001, when Californians were getting jerked around with a very deliberate, very cynical manipulation of the energy deregulation situation. And by the way, Schwarzenegger's campaign manager is Pete Wilson, who was the guy who put that energy deregulation into effect. And so at a very superficial level, his claim to be, I'm going to get the special interests out of Sacramento, and his claim to be an everyman is not only false, but is actually reminiscent of the way Hitler was portrayed to the German people. He was represented as someone who was not of the Junker nobility. He wasn't a general. He wasn't a rich industrialist. He was just everyman, but he became the Führer. And I don't think it's out of line, Dr. Stan, to see the marketing of Schwarzenegger to Weimar, California, so to speak, in a similar line. He's the everyman, but the one through the triumph of whose will has risen to the position that he has risen to. And his background, and I don't know how we're doing time-wise, how much time you want to take to go into his background.
Well, you go right ahead. You will hear the music when it swells, and I will let you know when we have to bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great North, and then we'll be back for the second hour. So you go ahead, and I'll just sort of be the referee and sit here and listen.
Okay, and if you want to take some questions from listeners or comments, just let me know, and this is your show here, so you just sort of direct me. Well, Schwarzenegger's father was a small-town police chief in a city called Thal in Austria. He previously had joined the Austrian SA when they were still illegal. He then became a member of a unit, the Feldgendarmerie 521. Those were the German military police, and he was assigned to Panzergruppe 4 on the Eastern Front. Now, Panzergruppe 4 saw some of the most brutal combat, and as you know, Dr. Stan, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, the combat on the Eastern Front in World War II was just a horror show, just a vast killing ground, a merciless, vast killing ground in which entire divisions burned like matches, just unimaginable atrocities were committed against civilian populations and on a scale that is inconceivable to many people. And the Feldgendarmerie had as one of their primary assignments liaising with the Einsatzgruppen. The Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing squads that accompanied the German frontline combat units and that did the liquidations. The Feldgendarmerie, or the chain dogs as they became known, were so hated that the Russians and Soviets actually put a bounty on the head of everyone that was killed, because they were one of the primary liaison functions for the butchers. And the Einsatzgruppe A that was associated with Panzergruppe 4 and that Schwarzenegger's father worked with liquidated some 2,030,000 Jews just in the 1941-1942 period, and that leaves aside all of the other people that they killed. A post-war investigation, which was just made public, indicated that Schwarzenegger's father was classified as a Class 3 war criminal, meaning that his unit had been heavily involved in atrocities, but that there was no personal indication that he himself had committed any atrocities, which is interesting, not in and of itself all that significant, because, of course, at this point in time, most of the witnesses, those who survived the war, are now dead. Stalin himself probably got rid of some of them. And people were not, of course, those who were being rounded up and slaughtered, weren't saying, hey, look at that Feldgendarm, look at that sergeant, that Feldwebel over there. Doesn't that look like Arnold Schwarzenegger's father? Because, of course, that Arnold Schwarzenegger's father had no meaning to people. But there are some indications that Schwarzenegger's father became an underground player in the underground Reich, because, of course, Austria was part of the Third Reich. Wounded veterans were one of the groups that were tabbed for post-war underground Reich work. He was one of those. Members of the police were seen as a particularly important repository for post-war underground Nazis. He was a member of the police. Members of the bureaucracy in general, those who were to present, who were to be involved in the infrastructure that was going to be needed by the Allied occupation government, were viewed as being primary candidates for underground work. And we know now that many of the units that were associated with the Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front became part of the outfit that Reinhard Gehlen and company glommed onto the CIA. And even beyond that, one of the main command units for the Einsatzgruppen, something called the Vorkommando Moscow, was a principal element in an illegal State Department's and CIA intelligence operation in the United States called the Crusade for Freedom. Now, under the Crusade for Freedom, which was hatched by Alan Dulles, who was, of course, the main officer of the OSS, the predecessor to the CIA, he was the main, along with his brother John Foster, the principal functionaries in Sullivan and Cromwell. It was Alan Dulles who had instituted the corporate masking to shield the Bush family's investments in Nazi Germany. And Alan Dulles basically oversaw the Crusade for Freedom. And this was a program under which Nazi war criminals and Eastern and Central European fascists, many of them affiliated with Gehlen, with the SS, these kinds of horrible atrocities were brought into the United States for political purposes. They were to be used in order to counteract perceived Jewish influence in areas, and they were to be used as an anti-communist influence.
Well, I'm going to have to interrupt you there, and you just hang right on. This is the time, of course, when I want to talk to our listeners in the Great Northwest and remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and you're going to hear things here that you will not hear elsewhere. We're trying to get people educated to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, historical battlefield. And, of course, the information we try to get to you will help to clarify what these issues are. And, of course, behind all the things that are going on, as someone once said, you know, back of all that foes have plotted, back of all that saints have planned, back of the schemes of men and demons is a higher hidden hand. Warp and woof our heaven created, every pattern good and wise, often perplexing by heavenly standards, but a good and right in heavenly eyes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time I simply want to point out that We are listener supported. We do hope many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call. We'll be glad to get it for you. And, of course, we'll be back with you again tomorrow night. Until then, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views I've expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guest, and the views of our callers. Well, this evening, our guest is Dave Emery, and we're talking about, of course, the background of the Martin Bormann operation, which, of course, was established even before the end of the Second World War, moved into South America with tremendous sums of money at its disposal, and began, of course, organizing through corporations and through Nazi sympathizers throughout the world for this future onslaught against the forces of freedom. And, of course, there were many, many people, of course, even in this country, working with us. And, of course, I believe there is a brotherhood of darkness. These people are not necessarily Nazis or Nazi sympathizers, but they have actually the same goals, and that is the establishment of a world government under a new ruling elite, a group of people who have certainly no loyalty to individual freedom, but would establish an authoritarian society. Now, of course, Dave has talked in the past about a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And I was able to track that down. It cost me about $150. It's very, very difficult to get, but we have it. We've started reading it. And fascinating to go into the background of the number two man in the Nazi movement. Went to South America, and of course the gentleman who wrote the book was a very well known and very well respected newspaper writer, worked for the New York Times. He spent a great deal of time tracking down Martin Bormann. Yes, he was there in South America, but of course they couldn't let the American people know that, because of course we were supposed to believe, the Nazis were all bad and we were all good, and the idea that we would actually not only tolerate but allow the Nazis to move to South America, indeed help them, and then allow them to continue operating. And the only one that was ever picked up was Adolf Eichmann, and he was picked up by the Simon Wiesenthal group, but the rest of them, Klaus Barbie and Mueller and the others, certainly Dr. Mengele, these people all managed to live very comfortable lives in South America. So why weren't we concerned? Why didn't we want to bring them, of course, before the bar of justice? And the truth is, why, of course, there are people in this country who are very sympathetic with their cause. So why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there, Dave?
Well, you've given a very nice summary of this. And, of course, Austria in World War II was part of the Greater German Reich. And Schwarzenegger's father, as I indicated, had served with some of the most notorious units. And in a couple of descriptions for programs, I've set forth a documentation that leads me to suspect that Arnold Schwarzenegger, for all of his liberal pretensions and for all of his loosey-goosey, ha-ha-ha sort of public persona, is actually, or may very well be, an operative of the Underground Reich. He was noted in Arnold, the unauthorized biography. There's quite a bit of text about Schwarzenegger joking around and giving the Nazi salute, parading around and doing goose-stepping around and playing Nazi speeches. Interestingly, Schwarzenegger was an ardent defender of Kurt Waldheim, who it turned out to the former UN Secretary General and Austrian President, who turned out to have been a notorious Nazi war criminal. Not only did Schwarzenegger defend him, he invited him to his wedding, he campaigned on behalf of Kurt Waldheim in Austria, and has never repudiated that decision. And there are some indications that Schwarzenegger may well be intended to be the Führer of the United States for an underground Reich. There's a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger that I found in Sports Illustrated's magazine of December 7th, 1987. The article itself is about Schwarzenegger. It's called Pecs Sell Ticks by a guy named Dan Gerringer. It's talking about sports figures who've made it in the motion picture industry. But on page 84 of Sports Illustrated of December 7th, 1987, there is a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger posing in a mountaintop wearing nothing but a tank suit and very obviously giving the Nazi salute. And I've got that up on my website so listeners can view that. And they should be aware that it's not a doctored picture. Of course, it's very easy these days to Photoshop a picture. But this is an actual picture of Schwarzenegger barefoot wearing just a tank suit in his bodybuilding days giving the Nazi salute.
And now, what is your website again?
It's spitfirelist.com.
Spitfirelist.
Spitfirelist.com. One word, SPITFIRELIST.com. And I've done two programs about Schwarzenegger, and they both, you can listen to them at a link that exists on Real Audio at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. And or you can read, because I put in long descriptions with text from books that aren't that readily available, you can read about not only Schwarzenegger, but about the Crusade for Freedom, in which these types of characters were brought into the United States by Alan Dulles, by Richard Nixon, who was a Dulles protege, by William Casey, who was the co-manager of the Bush-Reagan campaign. And the front for this was Ronald Reagan himself, although I doubt Reagan, from what I've been able to understand, Reagan was just kind of a gullible, nice guy. He didn't realize who he was fronting for. But the Bush family are heavily involved with these people, and there are indications that Schwarzenegger is, in fact, I believe, and this is opinion, but I believe he has been tabbed as the Führer of a Nazified and corrupted America. And the picture of him from Sports Illustrated is in the description for 421. That's FTR 421. I titled the broadcast, Pump This, the Schwarzenegger File. And then there's a follow-up program, FTR 422, which is called Total Recall, or it's called True Lies, More on Conan the Republican. And it's very, very interesting when one examines Arnold Schwarzenegger's career. There appears to be far more to it than what we have been told. And I can go into details, if you want to take listener phone.
I'll put this out. If anybody would like to call in, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But give us a call if you have a question. Otherwise, we'll have Dave go into some detail. Of course, I'm very concerned because of the relationship between Schwarzenegger and the CFR. He apparently has been over to Great Britain, visiting the castle of Lord Rothschild. He's rubbing shoulders with Reardon, with all the left wingers. Of course, the president seems to be very favorable to Schwarzenegger's candidacy. So, I mean, here's a fellow who just a couple of relatively a month or so ago, had never expressed, or at least never been, to my knowledge, ever to a Republican party function, and I was at all the party functions for a decade. He was never involved in any way with the Republican Party. And suddenly, after appearing on the Jay Leno program, he announces he's going to run for the governor. He's got, 22-24% of the vote. It just goes to show you that you really can fool most of the people a lot of the time.
Absolutely. And there are indications that very powerful interests had Schwarzenegger targeted for a long time. Again, you mentioned his visit to Waddesdon Manor in combination with Warren Buffett, among other powerful people. Many have defended his liberal credentials by pointing out his connection with the Kennedy family, but actually the Shrivers were closely associated with an ultra-reactionary, some might say overtly fascist, element within the Catholic Church called Opus Dei that had strong connections to Francisco Franco and that helped to elevate the current pope after the very precipitous death of Pope John Paul I when he was going to clean out the propaganda due Michele Sindona Roberto Calvi connections to the Vatican. And so that element of the Kennedy family that Arnold Schwarzenegger chose to ally himself with is one that has a very interesting history going back to an ultra-reactionary, again, some might say fascist, lay order within the Catholic Church called Opus Dei. And it's a very, very interesting thing. Another thing about Schwarzenegger is that when one studies his career, he is, if I were going to describe him in one word, it would be Machiavellian. He is not a nice person. If he's going to set you up and stick it to you, he will lead you in the opposite direction and then ambush you. Even in the way he handled his campaign, Dr. Stan, you'll notice that he had his aides and friends say that he was leaning against running, and then bam, came up on Jay Leno's show and pulled a quick one. That's the way Schwarzenegger works. When you study his MO, so to speak, he is very devious, has a Machiavellian character about him that would, in and of itself, be very, very, be absolutely inimical to any sort of political integrity, even if you didn't get into some of the background of his father. Interesting enough, when Arnold Schwarzenegger did his one-year compulsory service in the Austrian army, he wanted to be a tank driver, but he was too young. He was 18. But his father, and this requires a little bit of Lieutenant Columbo-like detective work, but his father, who was ostensibly just a small-town rural police chief, was able to prevail on the Austrian army to lower the minimum age for a tank driver from 21 to 18 just so his son could drive a tank. And that is unthinkable for in any army. A small-town police chief, if that's what he is, if that's all he is not going to be able to prevail on a federal army to lower the minimum age for a tank driver by 3 years. Later, Schwarzenegger, in his biography, Education of a Bodybuilder, mentions that he parked a tank but forgot to put the brake on. The tank then rolled into a river, but that he wasn't subject to any disciplinary measures. Well, that too, that might seem trivial to some listeners, but what I would recommend to anybody out there, the listeners or Dr. Stan, talk to somebody who's been in the military and ask them how credible that is.
Yeah, well, I've been in the military, and you don't, when your truck goes in the river, why, there are repercussions. But right now, let's go to Steve calling in from Carmel. Hi, Steve, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hello, Steve.
Yeah, I just had a question for the speaker. How many generations do you hold a man responsible for their father's actions?
It's not that Schwarzenegger should be held responsible for his father's actions, but the indications are that Schwarzenegger himself is part of an underground political structure that in all probability, at least in my opinion, is a continuation of the Third Reich. I think one should not judge Schwarzenegger on the basis of his father, but when one studies
Schwarzenegger's... You certainly have gone fairly deeply into his father's past.
Excuse me?
It seems like you've gone fairly deeply into his father's past trying to lead some sort of a connection to Mr. Schwarzenegger himself.
Yeah, well, I would recommend that you get on the internet and look at 421, FTR 421 and 422. There are indications simply in terms of Schwarzenegger himself that powerful forces are directing him into a position of primacy, into a position of authority. The analysis that I begin examines his father and his father's background and the qualifications that were deemed useful for post-war underground Reich work inside of what had been the fatherland against that. That's in FTR 421. Schwarzenegger has some very, very powerful forces behind him, and beyond that, his own behavior is not altogether inconsistent with what his father did, although he has been, after 1990, after an unauthorized biography by Wendy Lee came out, which discussed some of his veneer of Nazi behavior, then he became very active on behalf of the Wiesenthal Institute and the Museum of Tolerance. When you study Schwarzenegger, he's a very, very, very intelligent guy, very deliberate, and as I indicated earlier, very Machiavellian. His efforts in that regard began after the unauthorized biography came out. But there's quite a bit of anecdotal evidence of Schwarzenegger's engaging in the kind of activity that you can view on the website. Again, if you go to spitfirelist.com. And then scroll down to FTR 421. There are two different links to the picture right off of Sports Illustrated of Schwarzenegger giving the Nazi salute. Now, if that had been taken, you know, about 1 o'clock in the morning when he was drunk at a party or something, I wouldn't think much about it because certainly people do things when they're drunk and in a casual situation that one should not hold them accountable for, but. This is a very deliberate gesture. One doesn't simply go gallivanting barefoot through the mountains in a tank suit with a photographer and clad only in mineral oil in this tank suit and then flip the Nazi salute. And there's a lot of text in FTR 421 about Schwarzenegger's effecting of a veneer of Nazism.
Well, because, you know, the thing is that we lost... Steve, but, you know, I would not judge him by his father, although I think it's legitimate to mention this, but I would judge him by the fact that he obviously has very strong relations with people with the invisible government, or what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. And that is, of course, what my concern about him is, that he is not simply a casual actor, and I agree with you, he's been picked for what he's doing today. Let's go to Bill calling in from Florida. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. How are you doing?
Fine. Getting better. You can tell my voice is almost back to normal.
It's getting back there. I keep praying for you.
Thanks so much.
Wanted to ask your guest where Schwarzenegger stands on the Second Amendment and also ask him if he could explain what he means by Machiavellian. I've heard the term, but I don't know what that means.
All right, fine. Go ahead, Dave.
All right. As far as Second Amendment, meaning firearms ownership?
Yes. Yeah.
From what I've heard, Arnold Schwarzenegger is pro-gun control.
Right, but that's certainly my impression as well.
I personally am against gun control. I think that the issue is one that has been emotionalized to a tremendous extent. And also, my own political views tend to raise the hackles of both the right and the left, because I have my own views, and it's not I don't subscribe to the political dogma of either right or left. And for example, I'm very pro-union, which tends to run the right, that tends to aggravate the right wing, but I'm absolutely opposed to gun control. And so Schwarzenegger is pro-gun control. The word Machiavellian, refers to Niccolo Machiavelli, who was an Italian power political philosopher and writer. And his best-known work is called The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. And the word means basically a very deliberate, very cynical, very manipulative, dishonest, backstabbing type of political character. Dr. Stan, would you describe that as a good summary of Machiavellian?
Yes, I'd say that would be a very treacherous, somebody you couldn't trust at all, say one thing, mean another, stab you in the back. That would be Machiavelli.
I hope for y'all's sake that he doesn't get elected out there.
Well, of course, it may be a choice between Bustamante or Schwarzenegger, but of course I'm still hoping and praying that the good people will, of course, vote for a man of principle. We'll just have to wait and see, Bill. But I'll tell you, this is really one of the most important elections that I've ever lived through.
And
because we do have the option of an honest man.
Bear in mind, Bill, that there's a constitutional amendment that has now been introduced by Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah that might make Arnold Schwarzenegger eligible to run for president. Interestingly enough, in the movie The Demolition Expert, the characters at one point, and this came out in 1993, walk by the Arnold Schwarzenegger Presidential Library. See, I think, and this I want to stress to Dr. Stan and to the caller, that this is my opinion, but I think if you study Schwarzenegger's background, I think very powerful interests have selected him to become the sort of public clown that we will all view and be charmed by. And I think that he has been tabbed for power, and it's a scary thing if you study his character. If you can get a hold of the movie Pumping Iron, one of the things that I talk about in FTR 422, that even in his bodybuilding days, he gave a very strong indication that he was duplicitous, that he'd set people up and then knock them down. That's what he did with Lou Ferrigno in Pumping Iron. But he's done this throughout his career. He is, again, a very Machiavellian guy.
Okay, anything else, Bill?
No, that's it.
All right.
I'll keep praying for you.
Thanks so very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, and let's go to Nathan calling from Contra Costa. Hi, Nathan. Let me put our telephone number out again. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. How are you tonight, Nathan?
Mr. Emery.
Yes.
A real honor to speak with you. I have so much respect for you. I can't even imagine. I listened to your program, and believe me, I can't even express it. And I'm not a flatterer. I'm not a gusher. But in your case, I will definitely express this. Listen, my question for you is about the power that what we can call the Underground Reich or the Gala Network has. This is going to sound like a very, very weird question, and I hope that you'll take it appropriately, but do you think that it's going to begin to strike populations, let's say targeted populations, possibly relatively soon, i.e., you know, within a matter of months, that radical population control might in fact begin. God forbid, you know, that I would even speak it and it would come to pass. But do you see this on the horizon?
I do. I'm afraid of it. I can't say exactly when it's going to happen, but I'm afraid of. Did you hear earlier?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
When I was speaking about the use of proxy warriors. I'm afraid of perhaps an Al-Qaeda slash under Al-Taqwa underground Reich strike against the United States using Islamofascists with weapons of mass destruction. There are environmental weapons that can be utilized. The Tesla technology can be used. This will sound crazy. It's one of the difficult things about doing what I do, but there are, in fact, weapon systems that can use natural disasters such as earthquakes as weapons of mass destruction. I'm afraid those might be used as well. Then, of course, in the age of genetic engineering, we beasties can be fashioned to become weapons of mass destruction. And simply in terms of our current economic policy, there was a report which was commissioned and published by the U.S. Treasury Department. This is one of the reasons why Treasury Secretary O'Neill was fired by the Bush administration. There's been very little discussion of this in the American press, but the Financial Times of London, which is the voice of staid British business opinion, said that the current round of tax cuts is going to precipitate accrued budget deficits totaling $44.3 trillion, a tenfold increase in the publicly held national debt. And if one couples that with state budget deficits and with corporate debt and with personal debt, because the way they're trying to get the economy out of its doldrums is by lowering interest rates to such a point that people will borrow money in order to go out and buy products, cars, homes, clothing, furniture, what have you. But even if interest rates are low, you still are buying something on credit. You still have to make the payments. And one of the elements of mass destruction that looms very large, and this may be a new term to some members of the audience, but that is current accounts deficit. Now, this isn't the national debt. This isn't the budget deficits that the country is running, but it is the current accounts deficit is the sum total of all debt, public and private. That would be U.S. national debt, state debt, the debt of major corporations, and of individuals. And the U.S. is running an enormous current accounts deficit. And of course, we all know that sooner or later, if you're going to borrow money, you're going to have to pay it back. And the International Monetary Fund, and this, by the way, was completely blacked out in the United States. The IMF has warned the United States over its current accounts deficit and warned that it not only threatens the American economy, but the global economy as a whole. So in terms, and take this back to your question, in terms of modes of destruction that loom on the horizon, just imagine a country that is completely, a United States, that is utterly devastated economically, and where there's rioting in the streets, people haven't got enough to eat, they haven't got places to live, and then extend that situation to the world as a whole, because the United States has basically been the market into which other countries have imported their manufactured goods. So we have basically, in the boom of the 90s, we were the market that sustained, that drove the world economy, because as other countries' manufacturing establishments manufactured goods, they were shipped to the U.S., and they were bought by the American consumer. But if we are destroyed by our current accounts deficit and our other forms of debt, and I'm afraid we are going to be if we don't change, that's going to destroy the rest of the world as a whole. And I think that even leaving aside nuclear or biological warfare or Tesla technology weapons of destruction, the economy itself is very likely to produce a collapse and a degree of social conflict, a degree of absolutely murderous, traumatizing social conflict that would truly be a vision of hell, and that would lead any one of those inclinations to delight in what is taking place.
All right, anything else, Nathan?
So let me get this clear. You're saying that it could very well be a matter of months. let's say 4 months.
Yes, I'm afraid that it may be a matter of months. I think that the Bush administration has to be turned out. It really is the point element, in my opinion, for the underground Reich. And I've done a number of programs about that. Dr. Stan referred to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. I put the meat of that book online in FTR 305, that's FTR for the record 305, at spitfirelist.com. There's about an 18 to 20 page excerpt of that book. There's also a 6 or 7 page biography, professional biography of the late Paul Manning, who wrote the book. And there are many other programs that you can either listen to if you find that easier to do, or read if you find that easier to do, in which you can read about the problems confronting us. But I think that this current administration is the point element for the absolute essence, the vibrating, pulsating essence of evil itself. And I think that as a species, both as a biological and a spiritual species, I think that we have come to a time of absolute decision. I think that either the American people, and probably to an extent at least people abroad, are going to have to make civilization work. They're going to have to get serious about becoming civilized human beings and about effecting certain necessary reforms, and I think that both right and left are going to be quite shocked by some of the reforms.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thanks so much, Nathan. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dave Emery. Dave, of course, some years ago, there was a movie, there was a book, something about the Omega Strategy. Was that a fairly factual, as I recall, maybe it was the Omega factor, but it was a story of some reporter who was tracking down the Nazi movement in South America.
I don't recall that particular movie. There have been a number of films that dealt with that. Of course, there was the Odessa File.
That's the Odessa File. I'm sorry, I stand corrected.
The Odessa File dealt with that.
Now, was that a factual, or was that simply?
It was quite accurate. Yeah, and there have been some other films as well. The Marathon Man, starring Dustin Hoffman and Sir Laurence Olivier, touched on that. There was a movie which actually, I don't think it's a particularly good movie in that it's sort of standard Hollywood stuff, but there was a recent movie that I think was quite substantive in terms of its portrayal of the relationships of some of these realities, and that is the movie The Sum of All Fears. That came out in the summer of 2002, and some of it is Hollywood fluff, like you've got Ben Affleck, the beautiful, you know, Hollywood handsome hero, and then you've got the beautiful love interest who's a doctor. Ben Affleck plays a CIA officer. Then Morgan Freeman plays the head of the CIA. But it is about an underground Reich launching a nuclear terrorist incident on the United States using a combination of neo-Nazis and Palestinian activists. I believe that in it, and also using disaffected members of the Russian military at the same time.
In other words, it was trying, as I remember in the movie, to get a war going between Russia and the United States.
Yes.
That was the purpose of it.
And to destroy the United States.
Right.
And I think that, you know, again, for all of its superficial Hollywood stuff, I think that The Sum of All Fears was quite remarkable in the way in what it revealed about some of the realities, and I think it, for a recent major motion picture, I think that was about as close as anything I can recall seeing. And I was pleasantly surprised to see something like that making it into the mainstream media.
In fact, we have the in the movie, why, of course, they put the nuclear bomb in Baltimore. And I saw the movie, and I was on my way to Baltimore to a meeting. You had that just not very energy feeling. I know it was just a make-believe movie, but... Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And, of course, we're talking about the residual Nazi movement. But, of course, what energizes this from generation to generation are the spiritual forces which energized Adolf Hitler and the men who surrounded him. Because, of course, you know, it's simply not, it's more than an idea. You know, there are spiritual forces which energize any idea.
Yeah, absolutely. There are... One of the things that I've taken a fair amount of flack for on some of my research is that there actually are satanic elements, explicitly satanic elements, elements that are into a satanic religion that have political connections and that in turn have philosophical links and in some cases operational links running back to the Third Reich. I've spoken about a very insidious outfit, and this, when I say spoken, this is in some of the programs that I've done. There was an insidious outfit based in San Francisco in the late 80s called the Temple of Set, and this was an explicitly satanic cult run by a fellow named Michael Aquino, who was a lieutenant colonel. He was the Army's top psychological warfare expert at the time, an ex-Green Beret, a member of Mensa, a very brilliant and formidable man. But part of the spiritual program of the Temple of Set was to read Mein Kampf and to study the philosopher of Hitler. And there were all sorts of allegations involving child molestation and other things, ritual molestation. None of those ever were formally proved, but there were many people involved with the investigation who alleged that was, in fact, the case. I made an allusion to a book earlier in the program, Stan, a book called Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. That book was authored by Kevin Coogan. It's in print. It's available from Autono Media. And that is a great history of not only elements of the Third Reich, but how they maintained their political continuity in the post-war period, their very, very strong connections to the Middle East and elements that have now coalesced with both Al-Qaeda and the PLO, among others. And there's good discussion in Kevin Coogan's Dreamer of the Day about some of these occult connections to Nazism. There's a fellow named Julius Avila, for example. And Julius Avila is an occultist who was financed by the SS Intelligence Service. And his work has become quite influential in certain circles. One will find it in some New Age bookstores. Certain elements of the Nazi pop music feel, pop music, I guess, is the wrong term, but there actually is an element of Nazi and satanic. There is a Nazi and satanic element within the youth culture music, the so-called black metal milieu. And I was quite unpleasantly shocked to see some of this filtering its way, even into a station that I used to be affiliated with in the Bay Area. So some of these influences, which could be called explicitly satanic at one level, or certainly a cult, have found their way. And these are influences which are not at all apart from Nazism, from the realities of the underground Reich, but they are beginning to find their way into certain elements of culture. And that has been a subject of considerable ridicule. Then some people within the fundamentalist Christian community have exaggerated or misidentified certain symbols which are not necessarily satanic. But that is a very real factor. It's one that I've come up against both in terms of my research and in terms of actually running into some of these elements at some of the stations that I've worked at, and it's also garnered me a great deal of criticism and ridicule when I've called attention to it. But there's a long out-of-print book called Objective Evil, and it's about satanic cults within some elements of U.S. intelligence. So this stuff is there, and it is not pleasant.
And now, who wrote that Objective Evil?
I'm not sure off the top of my head, but let me go to my website. I'm going to have to go back here. This is at spitfirelist.com. And that was one of the earliest For the Record programs that I did. Here we go. The guy, perfect. Okay, the book is called Objective Evil, Satanic Cults in U.S. Intelligence. It was authored by a man who wrote under the name of R. Roy Blake. R as in Roger, Roy Blake, B-L-A-K-E.
That's probably a nom de plume, because, of course, if you wrote a book like that, your longevity would be very short. You should have your life insurance well paid up.
Well, in fact, I tried to interview him. I don't know if that's his real name. I believe it is. But in any event, I tried to contact him to do an interview, and he would not do an interview because he said his life had been threatened. The book, I believe, is now out of print. It was published in soft cover by Laramide or Laramide. That's out of Wyoming. L-A-R-A-M-I-D-E. Copyright 1995. So, Objective Evil, Satanic Cults and U.S. Intelligence by R. Roy Blake. Laramide Publishers, or Laramide, L-A-R-A-M-I-D-E. Copyright 1995.
Well, you know, of course, what you're talking about is so foreign to the average individual now. The people who listen to our program regularly understand that there really is this spiritual battle that we talk about, and there really are satanic forces, and they operate at every level of our society, including in the White House from time to time, depending upon who the president is. But certainly we had very good evidence that there were witches' coven meetings when Hillary was in the White House, and people who were going to write about that were simply warned that if they did write about it, why, it would cost them their lives, so they did not do it. But this is the sort of thing that's really going on, and you can't understand any of the things that that David Emery is talking about unless you understand these spiritual forces working behind the scenes.
There's a very interesting book called Secrets of the Tomb.
Right.
Out. And
Alexandra Robbins, right?
Yes, by Robba, a woman named Robbins. And this is about the Skull and Bones cult, of which both Georges Bush and Bush's father were members. And they practice all sorts of very interesting rituals. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Sr., robbed Geronimo's grave and brought the remains of the famous Apache war chief to the Skull and Bones headquarters. And then, according to Alexandra Robbins, Bush's uncle, Jonathan Bush, helped to protect when the San Carlos Apache voiced outrage. So in terms of examining some of this, I know George Bush, and this might upset some listeners, so I'll apologize in advance if that's the case, but George Bush is always talking about what a big Christian he is. He's Skull and Bones. He's a member of a devil-worshipping, grave-robbing Nazi occult group. If he's a Christian, I'm an avocado tree. it's just not very good stuff.
Well, and of course, it was very interesting when I had the opportunity of interviewing Alexandra on a number of occasions. We have a 4-tape set with my interviews with her included in the Skull and Bones tape set, but I'm sure you've read the book where at one point, of course, most of what she has in the book is what she was told by people affiliated with Skull and Bones. So I take all of that with a grain of salt. I think that they were feeding her false information. I think she's a very nice lady, and I think she was trying to be as honest and objective as she could. But at one point she talked about a woman who had actually witnessed a Skull and Bones wedding. And this was, of course, somebody who had no affiliation with the organization, had no reason to lie. And, of course, she's hiding up in the loft of a barn when, of course, they've had the regular wedding. And then they have the Skull and Bones wedding afterwards. And here are all these fellows with their robes, black robes, and they're chanting some sort of a bizarre pagan ritual. And of course, this woman is up there, and she starts to laugh, and they come up and they see she's there, and they threaten her. If you ever reveal what you've seen, you'll be killed. And of course, I said to Alexandra, I said, weren't you rather concerned to realize, of course, these leaders of the world were involved in this strange pagan activity. And you know, she hesitated for a minute. She said, well, you know, I really, really was. And of course, it was almost sort of like a revelation that, you know, it could be that occult. And that was, of course, certainly an independent observation, one of the very, very few, because nobody from the Skull and Bones ever really tells what goes on in there for fear of their life.
Yeah, I had heard somebody who, when I first heard of Skull and Bones, I had heard the allegations of grave robbing and that this actually is something that they engage in, that part of the manner in which one qualifies, you have to be a member of the elite to begin with. I mean, you don't just make it to Yale and then you get tabbed for Skull and Bones. But I had heard it alleged that part of the way in which one qualifies is to rob the grave of a famous person and to bring at least some of the remains back. I was frankly skeptical when I first heard it, but ever since then I've heard growing discussion of that, and in fact that the Skull and Bones ledger actually discusses the remains of Geronimo. So it's that's something that at this point I give a certain amount of credence to.
No, I'm sure that, you know, this is not a good organization, and of course it ties into a very ancient German organization. That this was the 322 was organized in, of course, 1832, and it was the second in a series of organizations. That was the number 322 beneath the skull. At least that is, of course, the explanation that they give for the number.
Well, it is a state of affairs that I think we really need to concern ourselves with, and I can't stress strongly enough to members of the listening audience to take advantage of the material that I've put online. There are hundreds and hundreds of hours of programming and at this point probably several thousand pages of printed documentation, and it's all free. It isn't going to cost any member of the audience anything but the time that it will take to download and or read. And with regard to Arnold Schwarzenegger, FTR, and again that stands for the record, 421 and 422 contain a detailed discussion of his record, some of the powerful interests that appear to be promoting him, his casual use of Nazi terminology and iconography. And that picture is also visible, and apparently that was not an unusual thing for Arnold Schwarzenegger to do. And the very powerful interests that are promoting him are all discussed there. So that's something that people should give some serious thought to.
Well, of course, one of the things I've heard, according to Alex Jones, and I think he has this on his website, he's been up to the Bohemian Grove. Now, that is, of course, for just the very elite. Of course, George Shultz is part of the Bohemian Grove, as is the Bush family, as was Richard Nixon and the Rockefellers and the Kissingers. And, you know, of course, this is truly an occult center, and they do have their occult ceremonies there, and they run around in the nude, and of course, the sexual exploits are really something we couldn't discuss on family radio. But of course, I'm a little disturbed to hear that Arnold has been invited there as a guest. I don't know if he's a member, but he's certainly been invited to the festivities.
I have not heard about Schwarzenegger himself being invited, but there was an article in the Chronicle, which I accessed in For the Record 421, that Karl Rove, who really appears to be the real president of the United States, he's the guy who makes the decisions, he was at Skull and Bone. He was, excuse me, at the Bohemian Grove, and he had basically voiced his opinion that Schwarzenegger should be the Republican gubernatorial candidate in California. By the way, I would note that Pete Wilson is a Yale graduate. I've never heard any allegations of his being a Bonesman, but he is a Yale graduate. I don't know if he's Skull and Bones or not, but Pete Wilson is Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign manager.
And, of course, you know, what you're just saying is the liberal takeover of the Republican Party. And, of course, as you pointed out, it was Pete Wilson that gave us this deregulation fiasco, and they knew it wasn't going to work. I mean, obviously, this was the matter of transfer of, tens of billions of dollars from the public into the coffers of PG&E and Southern California Edison. It was, I did some newsletters on that. It was the greatest scam of all time because, of course, every time they tried the deregulation, they tried it in England, they tried it in Chile, they tried it in Brazil, and every time it failed, because what you have then is a monopoly that, of course, is unregulated. Public utilities are regulated monopolies. You can't have a monopoly and then have it not regulated, and that's exactly what happened.
There was a very good paper talking about and people should understand, people in the state of California, that what we experienced with our outages and the huge increase in electricity rates was absolutely deliberate. With your permission, Stan, I'd like to read a couple of short paragraphs.
Go right ahead.
From a paper that is now online. It's called Fraud Traced to the White House, How California's Energy Scam Was Inextricably Linked to a War. It's authored by a woman named Catherine Eureka, Y-U-R-I-C-A, and the paper itself is called the Eureka Report, and there's a link to it on the Spitfire website, and this is going to read from FTR 420, which is called The Destabilization of California, and these two paragraphs are from Ms. Eureka's report. This story begins with the California energy crisis, which started in 2000 and continued through the early months of 2001, when electricity prices spiked to their highest levels. Prices went from $12 per megawatt hour in 1998 to $2,000 in December of 2000 to $250 in January of 2001, and at times a megawatt cost $1,000. One event occurred earlier. On July 13th, 1998, employees of one of the two power marketing centers in California watched incredulously as the wholesale price of 41 a megawatt hour spiked to $9,999, stayed at that price for 4 hours, then dropped to a penny. Someone was testing the system to find the limits of market exploitation. This incident was the earliest indication that the people in the state could become victims of fraud. The Sacramento Bee broke the story 3 years later on May 6, 2001. Today, Californians are still paying the costs of the debacle, while according to state officials, the power companies who manipulated the energy markets reaped more than $7.5 billion in unfair profits. And it's a really very dramatic stuff. And that, again, is on the Eureka Report. I was reading from the description for 420, FTR 420, from the SpitfireList.com website. And bear in mind that Pete Wilson, who was the person who put this regulation into place, is Arnold's campaign manager. And the Eureka Report discusses at considerable length a meeting between Kenneth Lay of Enron, which has now failed, which profited handsomely from this nonsense, and Dick Cheney and George Shultz and Arnold Schwarzenegger all getting together. Schwarzenegger and Reardon and Kenneth Lay were among the people who met at the Peninsula Hotel on May 29th of 2001 in order to basically help to craft Schwarzenegger's run for governor. And, of course, again, his campaign manager is Pete Wilson. So it's... It's a case of, if we do wind up with Schwarzenegger as governor, I think at the very least it would be an example of the fox being appointed to watch the hen house.
Well, you know, I was watching a Law and Order, I guess it was last night, and of course the man who plays the district attorney there was Fred Thompson, Senator Fred Thompson. He was an actor. They got him elected to the United States Senate. He spent six years in the United States Senate acting out his part, and now, of course, he is plays the part of the DA and in Law and Order. And of course, what you have to understand is they got him elected because he had name recognition, and the same thing is true with Arnold Schwarzenegger. What are his qualifications? Absolutely none. But of course, he will, if he gets into office, he will do what he's been told to do. And as you say, this has been planned for a very, very long time. The tragedy is, of course, there are kingmakers. There are people who give us the usually a choice of two candidates, and whichever one we vote for, we're not voting for the candidate of our choice, but the candidate of their choice. They're arranging this now for the next presidential election. I believe that Wesley Clark will probably be the Democrat nominee for the presidency. General Wesley Clark, member of the CFR, Rhodes Scholar, will be running against George Bush. This is the way it's looking now. And this has been planned, I think, for a long time, and then we can vote for whichever candidate we want to. But, of course, whichever candidate wins is their candidate.
Well, it's it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2004. One of the things that I find very scary is that there was a report in Newsweek this past summer that one of the Al-Qaeda-linked websites that is being monitored by U.S. intelligence carried an instruction to devout Muslims living on eastern seaboard coast cities to begin evacuation, which is in and of itself sort of scary. But one of the things to remember, Dr. Stan, is that the Republican convention is scheduled for New York in 2004. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the Democratic convention is scheduled to be in Boston. So if they're talking about, and those are the two cities that were mentioned as cities that Muslims should evacuate, they may try, the Al-Qaeda-linked forces, who are being used as proxy warriors by the underground Reich. And that may sound like a crazy thing to say, but there actually are some very well-documented links. Perhaps we can talk about that in a future show, or I certainly have a lot of documentation about that on my website.
Well, there's no question at all that, of course, the Arab leaders were very closely aligned with Adolf Hitler during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, Yasser Arafat is a protege of Otto Skorzeny, who was the head of the Odessa and also went to work for the Galen CIA contingent.
Let's go to Terry calling in there from Gilroy. We're just about out of time. Terry, how are you tonight?
Excellent.
You have a question or comment?
Yes, well, I'd thank you for your programs. They're always wonderful. And I've heard Dave Emery for a while, and I used to listen to Mae Breslow back in the day quite a bit. Great researcher she was. And we're sort of in the Great Awakening with all this material still coming to the forefront. And I wonder if Dave would touch on a subject again and go into more detail he touched on earlier, and that's the connection between Hitler and also Europe's other two fascist dictators, and the Concordat agreements they had with the Vatican that allowed them total support of Rome and, you know, allowed them basically to carry out what they did. And sort of tie that in, if you can, with, you know, the continuing this New World Order. You know, some people, there's a great book out called Vatican Assassins, and the New World Order has been called just an extension of the Third Reich, which was an extension of the Inquisition, which, if you know anything about the Jesuits, there's an excellent book called The Secret History of the Jesuits, and it goes into quite some detail and draws a lot of these situations together that Mae Brussel brought up and some of the great authors that Dr. Stan has had on over the years.
Sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're just about out of time. Let's get David's response to what you're saying.
Well, thanks for having Dave on.
Thanks so much.
That was great.
All righty, Terry. Well, again, I've got to sum this up real quick because of the limitations of time. Also, Dr. Stan, I'm going to be speaking about Arnold Schwarzenegger this coming Saturday in the Loudoun-Nelson Community Center.
That's Loudoun-Nelson this coming Saturday. It is just 2 days away then.
It is.
At what time will it be?
8 p.m., and the title of the lecture is going to be Total Recall, The True Lies of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
All right, fine. Well, I wish I could be there. I'll be out speaking, but I hope some of our listeners will want to go down 2 days from now. Loudoun-Nelson, 7 o'clock. Go ahead.
8 o'clock.
Actually. 8 o'clock, I'm sorry.
Yes. Now, there is a very strong link between the Vatican and fascism, and there are a number of different aspects to this. I can't even begin to do justice to the topic in the time left, but as early as 1919, Adolf Hitler was helping, was getting money from the Papal Nuncio to Munich, who was Archbishop Eugenio Pacelli. He later became Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli and ultimately became Pope Pius XII. Members of the Pacelli family helped to form the Concordat in 1929, in which the Catholic faith became the official state faith of fascist Italy under Mussolini. That also set up, by the way, the Vatican Bank, which subsequently became a source for all kinds of shenanigans, both during World War II and afterward. There was a big scandal about that in the early 1980s. Then the Vatican helped many of the top war criminals to escape under the auspices of Father Draganovic, and they were given passports by the Vatican Passport Office by Cardinal Giovanni Battista Montini. Eventually, Cardinal Montini succeeded Pius XII, and he became Pope Paul VI and continued to develop the relationship between the Vatican Bank and some of the residual fascist elements from fascist Italy in the P2 Lodge, headed up by Licio Gelli, honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration, by the way.
I'm afraid, Dave, we're out of time, but thank you so very much. We'll get you back one of these days, and we'll do the whole thing.
All righty. Well, Dr. Stan, it's been a pleasure.
It always is. God bless. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan just asking you to pray for America. We have real problems, as you can see, and of course, remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.